still going to counseling and AA meetings, but after a few months, he dropped the routine and started getting high whenever he could. At 2 a.m., standing on the porch of the Aldea Recovery House with a sack of clothes and his memory box, Scott took the natural next step and called Susie and Billy. He spent that night in their trailer, right back where he started. A few days later, as Susie baked an apple pie, Scott called his mom, Joan. He had decided to give methadone a try and needed two things, heroin in his system, which he had, and $150, which he didn't. A month earlier, Scott had returned to his hometown for a two-day visit. He stayed at his mother's small but dignified home, visited his grandmother in the nursing home, played video games with his teenage nieces, and watched his sister model her new wedding dress. It had been 2 years since Scott had seen his mother. "I would drive up to see you if I could drive in the city," Joan apologized without apologizing. The visit had been pleasant. Scott was relaxed and calm, not like his last visit when he seemed to Joan as nervous as a caged rabbit. "His legs would be shaking a mile a minute," she remembered. Joan had organized a special lunch and a big dinner so that all the relatives could see Scott. He'd traveled back to Milwaukee feeling loved, and that memory helped him pick up the phone. "It's a methadone clinic," Scott was saying. "Do you know what that is? I'll go to them every day to get the medication, and that'll help me with the opiate addiction and depression. I've kind of tried to do all this and beat this without. I didn't want you guys really to know the whole, you know, but it's not working that way." Scott drew a breath. "Mom, does this make sense to you?" All Joan knew was that her son, who almost never asked for anything, was asking for help. She came up with $150. The next morning, Scott sat in the 10th Street methadone clinic, waiting his turn. The clinic had four stations. Reception took your money, and collections took your piss. The nurses greeted regulars by their nicknames or numbers. "Hey, Dino. Your lucky day, 3322. The third station was the bathroom, equipped with a camera to make sure you weren't swapping urine. At the last station, the methadone dispensers sat behind a thick door on which someone had clipped an article from The Onion with the headline, "Everything Taking Too Long," accompanied by a photograph of a man staring impatiently at a microwave. Once buzzed in, patients stepped through the door and punched their number into a dispenser, which would squirt the bitter red liquid into a small plastic cup. Scott thought the most diverse place in all of Milwaukee had to be the methadone clinic at 7 a.m. Through its doors had walked a 20-something white woman in full makeup carrying a designer purse, a grunting Mexican man leaning on a walker, a white woman holding a newborn, a tall black man with earrings, whom Scott enjoyed looking at, a fat painter, a burly construction worker, a white woman in pressed slacks and a pink blouse, and a man in an accountant suit. When a bent-over Chinese woman who looked to be in her 80s shuffled into the clinic, a Puerto Rican woman with a cane walked over and hugged her. "You knew?" someone asked. Scott turned around to find a young white woman who looked like she belonged on the East High School track team. She was maybe 18, with a ponytail, freckles, orthodontic straightened teeth. Scott nodded, "Yes." "Well, my advice," the girl scooted closer, "is don't get on this stuff. I mean, they say they want to get you in to get you off, but it's all a lie. They just want your money. I've been on this for who knows how long, and I'm still taking 100 milligrams. Scott raised his eyebrows, recalling that 100 milligrams was the dose that had sent him to the hospital the last time he had tried methadone. As he remembered it, he had mixed the dose with Xanax and succumbed to the cocktail soon after leaving the clinic, stumbling into oncoming traffic. The responding officer injected him with Narcan, sending him into a convulsive withdrawal that landed him in the ICU. "How much do you pay?" Scott asked. $370, she answered, referencing her monthly bill. He nodded and wondered how he would make the next installment. When it was Scott's turn, he swallowed the red stuff, swished a little water in the cup, and downed the rinse. Those last drops could make a difference. Before he left, Scott met with a methadone counselor, a black man around Scott's age. "How many times in the last 30 days have you used heroin?" the counselor asked. 30? Scott went on to tell the counselor about his mother lending him the $150. I guess it's my fault for underestimating her, he said. Maybe I just cut her out of everything. You're as sick as your secrets, the counselor said. Because he couldn't afford both methadone and rent on his Serenity Club check, Scott went homeless. He checked into an 86-bed shelter called the Guest House. Every morning, he bused to the methadone clinic, and every evening, he slept on a bunk bed in a large room with other homeless men. Methadone made him sweat and gain weight, and it smothered his libido. But it worked. Most people who began methadone treatment dropped out within a year. Scott stuck with it. Over time, he became a resident manager at the guest house and started helping people again. 4 days a week, Scott worked in one of the guest house's satellite shelters, an unmarked three-story home with bay windows tucked in a quiet south side neighborhood. He scrubbed bathrooms with bleach and guided old-timers to the backyard picnic table, where they sat and tapped their cigarette ash into a repurposed Folgers coffee can. A year and almost $4,700 later, the county agreed to help Scott pay for his methadone, lowering his monthly bill to $35. Then, through a permanent housing program offered by the guest house, Scott was able to move into his own place, paying one-third of his income to rent. He chose the majestic loft apartments on Wisconsin Avenue, right next to the Grand Avenue Mall. He had always wanted to live downtown and had been a regular at the mall after first arriving in Milwaukee. Back then, to an Iowa farm kid at least, the mall was a vibrant social scene. The 14-story Majestic was built in 1908, originally for offices and a vaudeville theater. After it was converted into residential apartments, developers installed a fitness center, an indoor basketball court, a small private movie theater, and a putting green with artificial turf. Scott's apartment was on the 10th floor. It had clean, wheat-colored carpet, unblemished white walls, mini-blinds over person-length windows, a generous bathroom, and a working stove and refrigerator. The guest house furnished the apartment with a dark brown love seat and matching couch, a few lamps Scott reserved by leaving the plastic wrapping on the shades, and a full-size bed that Scott hardly used. Falling asleep on the couch had become a habit. There was even a stacked washer and dryer. It felt too good to be true. At first, Scott half believed that the guest house would call and say they had made a mistake. The apartment rented for $775 a month. Scott only paid $141. It took a good month before Scott was able to accept the apartment as his own. Once he did, he acquired a bathroom rug, a navy blue coverlet, hand soap, scented candles, throw pillows, mouthwash, dishes, and a welcome mat on which to place his shoes. The apartment made Scott feel affirmed, deserving of something better. It motivated him. One day, Scott used a magnet from the Society of St. Vincent de Paul to stick a note on his refrigerator. It read, 5-year plan. Back to nursing. Make a lot more money. Live as cheaply as possible. Start a savings account. 2 years and 3 months after losing his license, Scott was finally able to start scrimping for the lab tests he would need to become a nurse again. He even started collecting loose change for this purpose, keeping the coins in a kitchen jar. In the trailer park, Scott had felt stuck. I just didn't know how to fix anything, he remembered. It felt like the end of the earth down there, like none of the rest of the city existed. During that time, Scott often thought about killing himself. He'd have done it with a monster hit of heroin, but he never could find enough money. Scott's new place was such a stark contrast to his trailer and everything it represented that he began to think back on his time in the park as one big camping trip, removed from civilization. Sometimes, when he remembered those days and all he had lost, he would leave his apartment and wind his way through the Majestic's narrow, dimly lit hallways and come to a door. He'd open it and emerge in the middle of the Grand Avenue Mall, as if stepping through a secret passageway. Walking the mall's floors, Scott would take in the lights, music, food smells, and people, and remember how he used to feel years ago, when the city was still full of wonder and promise. 24. Can't win for losing. When Arlene dialed the number, she gave Jory her here-we-go look. A landlord, number 90, had left her a voicemail saying to give him a call. The message was from the landlord's son, actually, who had been the one to show Arlene the unit. He was in his early 20s with a backwards cap and a braided ponytail. "Call me Pana," he had said. Arlene remembered living in his father's building in 2003 in a two-bedroom unit that back then rented for $535. Now that same unit went for $625. So when Arlene applied this time, it was for a $525 one-bedroom unit. What a difference 6 years could make. The phone rang, and Arlene thought about what she had told Pana. She had lied about her income, saying she received $250 a month in child support, but had been straight about her evictions. Mainly, she had begged him. She told him she'd take the unit before looking at it. She didn't much consider the neighborhood or the condition of the place. "Whatever I get is whatever I get," she figured. She had said, "I'm in a shelter. Please?" Pana answered, "Yeah, so we checked you out. Everything was what you said it was, so we're going to work with you." Arlene jumped up and let out a muffled yes. "But you know, there is no room for error here." "I know. You're on a fixed income, so you need to pay your rent and not get into trouble." Arlene thanked Pana. Getting off the phone, she thanked Jesus. She smiled. When she smiled, she looked like a different person. The press had loosened its grip. From landlords, she had heard 89 no's, but one yes. Jory accepted his mother's high five. He and his brother would have to switch schools. Jory didn't care. He switched schools all the time. Between 7th and 8th grades, he had attended 5 different schools, when he went at all. At the domestic violence shelter alone, Jory had racked up 17 consecutive absences. Arlene saw school as a higher order need, something to worry about after she found a house. Plus, Jory was a big help. He would bound down the street and memorize numbers off rent signs or watch Jafaris when Arlene left with her house notepad. He was good for a laugh, too. When things looked bleak, he would try to make his mama smile by freestyling, badly, as the city rolled past their bus window. I, looking for me a house to move in. That was my old school. That's my old block. That's my old gas station. We looking for a house. If Jory worried about finding a home, he never showed it. Jafaris cried when they left the shelter, holding onto the remote control car and stuffed Elmo a social worker had given him as parting gifts. "I can't look," he said as the car pulled away. Arlene rubbed her boy's head and told him he should be happy leaving the shelter. Jafaris didn't understand why. It was quiet and warm, and there were toys there. Their new apartment building was at the busy intersection of Teutonia and Silver Spring, in a more industrial part of the north side. Arlene climbed the steps to the third-floor apartment, while Jory and Jafaris took a giggling ride in the creaking elevator. Inside, the walls were freshly painted, and the gray carpet was thick and clean. There was an air conditioning unit and fixtures on every light. There was a small kitchen with light wood cupboards, each one of which had a handle. The hot water worked. Arlene took her time inspecting the place, but couldn't find anything wrong. She opened a window and looked out over the cars driving by and our Steel and Heating's distribution center across the street. She felt good but tired. Once all the trash bags of clothes and boxes of canned food were moved in, Arlene sat on the floor. She found a soft bag and leaned back on it. She felt at peace, at home. It had been 2 months since her eviction hearing with Sharina. Jory sat down beside Arlene and pitched his head into her shoulder. Jafaris followed, lying on Arlene's legs and resting his head on her belly. They stayed like that for a long time. After a few quiet days, Arlene learned that Terrence, everyone just called him T, was dead. T was one of the only people Arlene still kept in touch with on Larry's side of the family. His cousin, P.A., whom Arlene also loved, had shot him. During an argument, T had hit P.A. over the head with an axe handle, and P.A. went to get a gun. Before he returned, he called T's mother, saying that he was going to kill her son. Then he did. T's death interrupted Arlene's life in the usual way. She wept for him and reminisced with old friends and arranged for Jafaris to stay over at his old foster mother's home during the funeral. He was too young to go, Arlene thought. Some people were talking about going to Ponderosa's steakhouse after the funeral. Those who couldn't afford it donated plasma so they could have a place at the table. When Arlene and Jory visited T's street memorial near Fond du Lac Avenue on the northwest side, she straightened the flowers and stuffed animals. It was a handsome memorial, adorned with a large cream ribbon, poems, silk roses, and several bouquets of white and yellow daisies, carnations, and alstroemeria. Arlene walked to T's house and stood on the steps, walked back to the memorial, then walked to the steps again.
"Time is going fast, ain't it?" Jory said. "I bet when we get down to the funeral, time will be going slow."
On the morning of the funeral, Arlene put on dark jeans, a rock-aware T-shirt, and a blue hoodie. As she and Jory descended the stairs on their way out, they met Pana on his way up.
"I need to talk with you," he said. "About 2 nights ago."
Arlene's mind raced. That was when she had called 911 because Jafaris was having an asthma attack.
"This is a nuisance building," Pana said. "We can't have police coming up in here."
"Just the fire department and ambulance came," Arlene said. "Police don't come for an asthma attack."
Still, that wasn't the only issue. A neighbor had complained that one of Arlene's friends had knocked on his door and asked for weed. Trisha. She was babysitting the boys at the time. And Jafaris had been caught dropping something out their third-story window.
"If things don't get better, we are going to ask you to go."
Outside, on her way to New Pitt's mortuary, Arlene shook her head.
"If it ain't one thing, it's another," she said.
Besides trying to stay in Pana's good graces, Arlene was having a problem with her food stamps. She had submitted the necessary change of address form, but there was some holdup. Then there was the problem of getting everything out of storage. She needed to find a way to move her things fast or, come the first of the month, she would fall behind on payments, either that or fall behind in rent. And now T was gone and, in a way, so was PA. Poverty could pile on. Living it often meant steering through gnarled thickets of interconnected misfortunes and trying not to go crazy. There were moments of calm, but life on balance was facing one crisis after another. At least Arlene had a home, a floor of her own to sleep on. Arlene hesitated in front of the door at Pitt's. Built in the 1930s, the funeral home on West Capitol Drive was a North Side institution. Fashioned in the French Revival style, the Lannan stone building was adorned with an octagonal stair tower. Thin, elegant windows, a deep maroon entrance canopy stretching across the sidewalk, and steep roof lines with a towering chimney. Jory drew up next to his mother, and they walked in together. The sanctuary was packed. Teenagers and children huddled together wearing personalized shirts with T's face or the face of someone else who had been cut down young. Grandmothers and grandfathers were there in cream and brown suits with matching felt hats. Big C, T's brother, was up front in a crisp blue T-shirt with matching bandana and sunglasses. Uncle Link showed up with a half-finished cigarette behind his ear. A towering man walked down the aisle, slowly, as his wife leaned her face on his back and wept. Arlene took a seat at the rear, reflecting her status in the family. T looked good, dressed in a long-sleeved black T-shirt and a new Oakland Raiders cap. He had almost made 40. The preacher looked down on him.
"It seems like every time I come over here, I see someone who looks like me lying in a casket, gone too young," he said, shaking his head above a fat Windsor knot. Then he boomed, raspy and impassioned. "What has happened to the love amongst us? What has happened to the concern? Can't nobody help us but us."
"Go on. That's right. That was my baby."
After it was over, Arlene joined Uncle Link and a few others outside. Someone handed her a can of Old English malt liquor, and she poured it out for tea, making pretty amber circles in the snow. At the repast, the family ate fried chicken on bread, greens, and mac and cheese in the basement of the Wisconsin African American Women's Center on 30th and Fleet.
Through it all, Arlene was embraced and kissed and welcomed. She felt held by her people. They weren't much help if you needed a place to stay or money to keep the heat on, but they knew how to throw a funeral. The next day, no one was calling, and Arlene got back to making her apartment a home. She enrolled the boys in new schools. She got her stuff out of storage and hung pictures on the wall. A neighbor gave her a couch. Arlene's old apartment on 13th Street was usually messy because cleaning didn't do it much good, what with its cracked windows, ravaged carpet, and broken bathroom. But Pana's father kept a nice place. It could look respectable if Arlene kept it nice. She did. Over the sink, she wrote a little note to Jory. "If you don't clean up after yourself, we're going to have problems." On the counter, she set out a candle for St. Jude, patron saint of difficult cases. When people saw Arlene's apartment, they would say, "Your house is so pretty." Some even asked if they could move in. Arlene would feel proud and say no. Jory tried to adjust to his new school. He was technically in eighth grade, but so far behind that he might as well have been in seventh. It was frustrating. And on top of that, T's death had unsettled him. It had come out that when P.A. called T's mother, he had called from Larry's phone. The police questioned Larry but released him. It still twisted Jory up inside. Why was his daddy with P.A. that night? Exactly 2 weeks after the funeral, a teacher snapped at Jory, and he snapped back. He kicked the teacher in the shin and ran home. The police followed him there, the teacher having called them. When Pana heard about it, he made Arlene a deal. If she left by Sunday, he'd return her rent and security deposit. If she didn't, he would keep her money and evict her. Children didn't shield families from eviction. They exposed them to it. Arlene took the deal, and Pana was nice enough to help her move. She pulled her dishes out of the clean cupboards and took her decorations off the walls. When Arlene had finished stuffing everything into trash bags and recycled boxes, Pana loaded his truck and drove Arlene's things right back to storage. Arlene had lost the pretty house and felt miserable about it. "Why is it like I got a curse on me?" she wondered. "I can't win for losing, no matter how hard I try." Arlene called Tricia and told her how angry the landlord was when he found out she had been going door to door asking for a joint. It really was the police visit that did her in. But years of hardship had taught Arlene how to ask for help, and one particularly effective method involved addressing a person's guilt, framing things so that someone looked like a real bastard if he or she turned you down. "The least you can do is help me if you're the one that got me put out." Tricia told Arlene to come on over. There was a new street memorial on 13th Street. Jafaris noticed it. "Someone got shot there," he said in his 6-year-old voice. When they arrived at the old address, the boys ran up to Trisha's apartment to see Little. But Little was dead. A car had ground him into the pavement. When Tricia told Jory, he tried to keep himself from crying. He paced around Trisha's apartment and sleeve attacked the snot sliding from his nose. He found a foam mannequin's head. There was always random stuff like that lying around Trisha's place. Jory knelt over the head and turned it face up. He hit the face with a closed fist. He kept hitting it. Soon he was grunting, and his punches flew faster and harder and louder until Arlene and Tricia screamed at him to stop. Tricia didn't hide the fact that she had begun turning tricks. She couldn't, even if she wanted to. Men would just show up, and Tricia would take them into her bedroom, telling Arlene, "Look, I'm about to get us some cigs." Tricia would emerge later with $8 or $10. Once, Jory walked in to find a man in bed with Tricia, his pants on the floor next to them, and her lipstick smeared. In crowded houses, there were no separate spaces, and children quickly learned the ways of adults. Tricia kept at it even after her new boyfriend moved in. Arlene sensed that he encouraged her to. She also figured it was the boyfriend who told Tricia to raise Arlene's monthly rent to $150 from $60. The man went by a string of nicknames. Tricia called him Sonny. He was a 30-year-old man who had just served 5 years for selling drugs. Skinny, with a smooth walk, he bragged about having 9 children by 5 different women and joked about taking a spatula to Tricia. When Tricia got money from John's or her payee, Sonny would take it. If Tricia called after Sonny on the street, he would ignore her and later hiss, "Don't call me babe in public." Tricia would ball up under the covers with her clothes on or sit on a windowsill and light a cigarette, its smoke coming alive in the breeze like a raging spirit that had only seconds to live. Sonny's parents and one of his sisters moved in soon after Arlene did. Tricia's small one-bedroom apartment, which was in bad shape to begin with, began to buckle under the weight of 8 people. The toilet broke, and the kitchen sink started leaking. The leak got so bad that the floor filled with water that would ripple when Jory stepped in it. He spread old clothes on the ground to sop it up.
"It looks like slums," Arlene said. "Kitchen all nasty, floor all nasty, bathroom."
She thought about what to do next.
"What's beyond this? What's to come? It can't get no worser."
Then a Child Protective Services caseworker showed up asking for Ms. Bell. It was not Arlene's usual caseworker, but one she'd never met before. She knew Arlene was living there. Sharina didn't even know that. And she knew about the toilet and the sink. The caseworker opened the refrigerator and grimaced. Arlene pointed out that it was the end of the month. She had gone shopping, but there were 8 mouths to feed. The CPS worker said she'd be back. Arlene became nauseous with anxiety and secretly suspected Tricia had reported her. She needed to escape somehow. So she called JP. Her dependable cousin picked her up and rolled her a blunt. It helped. So he rolled another.
"JP always tries to make me forget about all my stress," Arlene said the next day.
Finally, spring had come to the city. The snow had melted, leaving behind wet streets edged in soggy garbage. On the same day, the whole ghetto realized there was no longer a need to brace and tighten when stepping outside. People overreacted without regret. Boys went shirtless and girls put lotion and sun on their legs long before it was actually hot. Chairs and laughter returned to porches. Children found their jump ropes. Arlene and her boys had spent the past several days alone in Tricia's apartment. She relished the peace and quiet. Tricia and Sonny and Sonny's people had disappeared. Arlene didn't give it any thought, figuring they were visiting kin or friends. But on May 1st, movers stormed Tricia's apartment. They came with gloved hands, ready to work, but ended up looking at each other bewildered, trying to figure out what they should pack and what they should trash. Belinda, Tricia's payee, had contracted the men. She would later come check on their progress, pulling up in a new Ford Expedition XLT with temporary license plates from the dealership. Chris had been released and came by the apartment looking for Tricia. Belinda didn't think her client was safe on 13th Street anymore. Arlene stared out the front window.
"This is too much for me," she mumbled.
She had stayed with Tricia for a month and a half. Jafaris came home from school with braids on one side of his head. He watched the movers lugging out mattresses and dressers and shoving handfuls of clothes into black trash bags. To this scene, he had no reaction. He did not cry or ask a question or run to check on a special possession. He simply turned around and went outside. They stayed a while with Arlene's sister, who wanted $200 a month, even though Arlene and the boys didn't have their own room. During that time, Arlene lost everything she had in storage. Her glass dining table, the armoire and bedroom dresser she had acquired at 13th Street, her air conditioning units. She had given Boosie the money to pay it, but he lost or stole it. Then Arlene's welfare case was closed because she missed 3 appointments. The letters had once again been mailed to an address she was evicted from.
"It won't stop for nothing," she said.
Arlene eventually found another run-down apartment on 34th in Clark, by the Master Lock Factory.
"Maybe this will be the end of it," she told herself.
Arlene found enough stability to start looking for jobs, but not long after an interview at Arby's, she and her boys were robbed. 2 men ran into her apartment and stuck a pistol in Jory's face. Arlene's caseworker told her the place was no longer safe, causing Arlene to flee once again to a shelter. Rents continued to rise. Arlene's next apartment took $600 of her $628 monthly check. It was only a matter of time before her lights were shut off. When that finally happened, Jory went to live with Larry, and Child Protective Services placed Jafaris with Arlene's sister. Arlene began to unravel.
"Just my soul is messed up," she said. "Sometimes I find my body trembling or shaking. I'm tired, but I can't sleep. I'm fitting to have a nervous breakdown. My body is trying to shut down."
Arlene stood back up. She borrowed money from her Aunt Merva to get her lights back on, and her boys came back. She took another apartment on Tamarack Street, near Tabernacle Community Baptist Church. This apartment had no stove or refrigerator, but they boiled hot dogs in a crock pot or went to St. Ben's to eat beef stroganoff with the winos. Sometimes, Arlene would head out to a food pantry, and Jafaris would ask,
"Will you get me some cakes, Mama?"
Arlene would smile and say,
"You know I'll try if they have them."
Jory had been thinking about his future. He wanted to become a carpenter so he could build Arlene a house.
"People be not thinking that I can do this, but you watch," he said.
Arlene smiled at Jory.
"I wish my life were different," she said. "I wish that when I be an old lady, I can sit back and look at my kids, and they be grown, and they, you know, become something. Something more than me. And we'll all be together and be laughing. We be remembering stuff like this and be laughing at it."
Epilogue. Home and Hope. The home is the center of life. It is a refuge from the grind of work, the pressure of school, and the menace of the streets. We say that at home, we can be ourselves. Everywhere else, we are someone else. At home, we remove our masks. The home is the wellspring of personhood. It is where our identity takes root and blossoms. Where as children, we imagine, play, and question. And as adolescents, we retreat and try. As we grow older, we hope to settle into a place to raise a family or pursue work. When we try to understand ourselves, we often begin by considering the kind of home in which we were raised. In languages spoken all over the world, the word for home encompasses not just shelter, but warmth, safety, family, the womb. The ancient Egyptian hieroglyph for home was often used in place of mother. The Chinese word jia can mean both family and home. Shelter comes from two old English words, skild, shield, and truma, troop, together forming the image of a family gathering itself within a protective shell. The home remains the primary basis of life. It is where meals are shared, quiet habits formed, dreams confessed, traditions created. Civic life, too, begins at home, allowing us to plant roots and take ownership over our community, participate in local politics, and reach out to neighbors in a spirit of solidarity and generosity. Alexis de Tocqueville once observed, "It is difficult to force a man out of himself and get him to take an interest in the affairs of the whole state. But if it is a question of taking a road past his property, he sees at once that this small public matter has a bearing on his greatest private interests." It is only after we begin to see a street as our street, a public park as our park, a school as our school, that we can become engaged citizens, dedicating our time and resources for worthwhile causes. Joining the neighborhood watch, volunteering to beautify a playground, or running for school board. Working on behalf of the common good is the engine of democracy, vital to our communities, cities, states, and ultimately, the nation. It is an outflow of the idealism and moralism of the American people, wrote Gunnar Myrdal. Some have called this impulse love of country or patriotism or the American spirit. But whatever its name, its foundation is the home. What else is a nation but a patchwork of cities and towns? Cities and towns, a patchwork of neighborhoods. And neighborhoods, a patchwork of homes. America is supposed to be a place where you can better yourself, your family, and your community. But this is only possible if you have a stable home. When Scott was provided with an affordable apartment through the guest house's permanent housing program, he was able to stay off heroin, find meaningful work as a resident manager for homeless people,
and begin striving for independence. He remains stably housed and sober. And then there are the Hingstons. After Malik Jr. was born, Patrice and Doreen finally did move to Brownsville, Tennessee, a town of about 10,000. They found a nice three-bedroom place. Out of the rat hole, Patrice earned her GED, impressing her teacher so much that she was named Adult Learner of the Year. Patrice went on to enroll in a local community college, where she took online classes in computers and criminal justice, hoping to one day become a parole officer. She liked a half joke. "I got a lot of friends who are criminal who are going to need my help." The persistence and brutality of American poverty can be disheartening, leaving us cynical about solutions. But as Scott and Patrice will tell you, a good home can serve as the sturdiest of footholds. When people have a place to live, they become better parents, workers, and citizens. If Arlene and Vanetta didn't have to dedicate 70 or 80% of their income to rent, they could keep their kids fed and clothed and off the streets. They could settle down in one neighborhood and enroll their children in one school, providing them the opportunity to form long-lasting relationships with friends, role models, and teachers. They could start a savings account or buy their children toys and books, perhaps even a home computer. The time and emotional energy they spent making rent, delaying eviction, or finding another place to live when homeless could instead be spent on things that enriched their lives. Community college classes, exercise, finding a good job, maybe a good man too. But our current state of affairs reduces to poverty people born for better things. For almost a century, there has been broad consensus in America that families should spend no more than 30% of their income on housing. Until recently, most renting families met this goal. But times have changed, in Milwaukee and across America. Every year in this country, people are evicted from their homes, not by the tens of thousands or even the hundreds of thousands, but by the millions. Until recently, we simply didn't know how immense this problem was, or how serious the consequences, unless we had suffered them ourselves. For years, social scientists, journalists, and policymakers all but ignored eviction, making it one of the least studied processes affecting the lives of poor families. But new data and methods have allowed us to measure the prevalence of eviction and document its effects. We have learned that eviction is commonplace in poor neighborhoods, and that it exacts a heavy toll on families, communities, and children. Residential stability begets a kind of psychological stability, which allows people to invest in their home and social relationships. It begets school stability, which increases the chances that children will excel and graduate. And it begets community stability, which encourages neighbors to form strong bonds and take care of their block. But poor families enjoy little of that because they are evicted at such high rates. That low-income families move often is well known. Why they do is a question that has puzzled researchers and policymakers because they have overlooked the frequency of eviction in disadvantaged neighborhoods. Between 2009 and 2011, roughly a quarter of all moves undertaken by Milwaukee's poorest renters were involuntary. Once you account for those dislocations, eviction, landlord foreclosure, low-income households move at a similar rate as everyone else. If you study eviction court records in other cities, you arrive at similarly startling numbers. Jackson County, Missouri, which includes half of Kansas City, saw 19 formal evictions a day between 2009 and 2013. New York City courts saw almost 80 non-payment evictions a day in 2012. That same year, 1 in 9 occupied rental households in Cleveland and 1 in 14 in Chicago were summoned to eviction court. Instability is not inherent to poverty. Poor families move so much because they are forced to. Along with instability, eviction also causes loss. Families lose not only their home, school, and neighborhood, but also their possessions, furniture, clothes, books. It takes a good amount of money and time to establish a home. Eviction can erase all that. Arlene lost everything. Lorraine and Scott, too. Eviction can cause workers to lose their jobs, the likelihood of being laid off, is roughly 15% higher for workers who have experienced an eviction. If housing instability leads to employment instability, it is because the stress and consuming nature of being forced from your home wreak havoc on people's work performance. Often, evicted families also lose the opportunity to benefit from public housing because housing authorities count evictions and unpaid debt as strikes when reviewing applications. And so people who have the greatest need for housing assistance, the rent-burdened and evicted, are systematically denied it. This, the loss of your possessions, job, home, and access to government aid, helps explain why eviction has such a pronounced effect on what social scientists call material hardship, a measure of the texture of scarcity. Material hardship assesses, say, whether families experience hunger or sickness because food or medical care is financially out of reach, or go without heat, electricity, or a phone because they can't afford those things. The year after eviction, families experience 20% higher levels of material hardship than similar families who were not evicted. They go without food. They endure illness and cold. Evicted families continue to have higher levels of material hardship at least 2 years after the event. These families are often compelled to accept substandard housing conditions. In Milwaukee, renters whose previous move was involuntary were 25% more likely to experience long-term housing problems than similar renters who moved under less trying circumstances. And families forced from their homes are pushed into undesirable parts of the city, moving from poor neighborhoods into even poorer ones, from crime-filled areas into still more dangerous ones. Arlene's favorite place was nested in a working-class black neighborhood. After the city condemned it and forced her out, she moved into an apartment complex teeming with drug dealers. Even after controlling for a host of important factors, families who experience a forced move relocate to worse neighborhoods than those who move under less demanding circumstances. Concentrated poverty and violence inflict their own wounds, since neighborhoods determine so much about your life, from the kinds of job opportunities you have to the kinds of schools your children attend. Then there is the toll eviction takes on a person's spirit. The violence of displacement can drive people to depression and, in extreme cases, even suicide. 1 in 2 recently evicted mothers reports multiple symptoms of clinical depression, double the rate of similar mothers who are not forced from their homes. Even after years pass, evicted mothers are less happy, energetic, and optimistic than their peers. When several patients committed suicide in the days leading up to their eviction, a group of psychiatrists published a letter in Psychiatric Services identifying eviction as a significant precursor of suicide. The letter emphasized that none of the patients were facing homelessness, leading the psychiatrists to attribute the suicides to eviction itself. Eviction must be considered a traumatic rejection, they wrote, a denial of one's most basic human needs, and an exquisitely shameful experience. Suicides attributed to evictions and foreclosures doubled between 2005 and 2010, years when housing costs soared. Eviction even affects the communities that displaced families leave behind. Neighbors who cooperate with and trust one another can make their streets safer and more prosperous. But that takes time. Efforts to establish local cohesion and community investment are thwarted in neighborhoods with high turnover rates. In this way, eviction can unravel the fabric of a community, helping to ensure that neighbors remain strangers and that their collective capacity to combat crime and promote civic engagement remains untapped. Milwaukee neighborhoods with high eviction rates have higher violent crime rates the following year, even after controlling for past crime rates and other relevant factors. Losing your home and possessions, and often your job. Being stamped with an eviction record and denied government housing assistance. Relocating to degrading housing in poor and dangerous neighborhoods, and suffering from increased material hardship, homelessness, depression, and illness. This is eviction's fallout. Eviction does not simply drop poor families into a dark valley, a trying yet relatively brief detour on life's journey. It fundamentally redirects their way, casting them onto a different and much more difficult path. Eviction is a cause, not just a condition of poverty. Eviction affects the old and the young, the sick and able-bodied. But for poor women of color and their children, it has become ordinary. Walk into just about any urban housing court in America, and you can see them waiting on hard benches for their cases to be called. Among Milwaukee renters, over 1 in 5 black women report having been evicted in their adult life, compared to 1 in 12 Hispanic women and 1 in 15 white women. Most evicted households in Milwaukee have children living in them. And across the country, many evicted children end up homeless. The substandard housing and unsafe neighborhoods to which many evicted families must relocate can degrade a child's health, ability to learn, and sense of self-worth. And if eviction has lasting effects on mothers' depression, sapping their energy and happiness, then children will feel that chill too. Parents like Arlene and Vanetta wanted to provide their children with stability, but eviction ruined that, pulling kids in and out of school and batting them from one neighborhood to the next. When these mothers finally did find another place to live, they once again began giving landlords most of their income, leaving little for the kids. Families who spend more on housing spend less on their children. Poor families are living above their means in apartments they cannot afford. The thing is, those apartments are already at the bottom of the market. Our cities have become unaffordable to our poorest families, and this problem is leaving a deep and jagged scar on the next generation. All this suffering is shameful and unnecessary. Because it is unnecessary, there is hope. These problems are neither intractable nor eternal. A different kind of society is possible, and powerful solutions are within our collective reach. But those solutions depend on how we answer a single question. Do we believe that the right to a decent home is part of what it means to be an American? The United States was founded on the noble idea that people have certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Each of these three unalienable rights, so essential to the American character that the founders saw them as God-given, requires a stable home. Life and home are so intertwined that it is almost impossible to think about one without the other. The home offers privacy and personal security. It protects and nurtures. The ideal of liberty has always incorporated not only religious and civil freedoms, but also the right to flourish, to make a living however one chooses, to learn and develop new skills. A stable home allows us to strive for self-reliance and personal expression, to seek gainful employment and enjoy individual freedoms. And happiness? It was there in the smile that flashed across Jory's face when Arlene was able to buy him a new pair of sneakers. In the church hymn, Lorraine hummed when she was able to cook a nice meal. In the laughter that burst out of the Hingston's house after a good prank. The pursuit of happiness undeniably includes the pursuit of material well-being. Minimally, being able to secure basic necessities. It can be overwhelming to consider how much happiness has been lost, how many capabilities snuffed out by the swell of poverty in this land, and our collective decision not to provide all our citizens with a stable and decent place to live. We have affirmed provision in old age, 12 years of education, and basic nutrition to be the right of every citizen because we have recognized that human dignity depends on the fulfillment of these fundamental human needs, and it is hard to argue that housing is not a fundamental human need. Decent, affordable housing should be a basic right for everybody in this country. The reason is simple. Without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. How can we deliver on this obligation? The good news is that much has already been accomplished. America has made impressive strides over the years when it comes to housing. In generations past, the poor crowded into wretched slums, with many apartments lacking toilets, hot water, heat, or windows. Death and disease were rampant. Over the generations, the quality of housing improved dramatically, and to address the problem of affordability, bold and effective programs were developed. In the middle part of the 20th century, housing was at the forefront of the progressive agenda. High-rise housing projects were erected to replace slums, sometimes in a single massive sweep. Cutting the ribbon for a new public housing project was an occasion to celebrate, the late housing economist Lewis Winnick remembered. Big city mayors and aldermen trolled for votes by pledging a towering public housing project for the ward. When public housing residents saw their apartments, all airy and new, nested in complexes surrounded by expansive grassy fields and playgrounds, they were thrilled. "It is a very beautiful place," one said, "like a big hotel resort." But soon, the great towers erected to replace slums became slums themselves. After politicians choked off funding, public housing fell into a miserable state of disrepair. Broken windows, plumbing, and elevators stayed that way. Outside, sewer openings were left uncovered and trash piled up. Families who could move did, leaving behind the city's poorest residents. Soon, public housing complexes descended into chaos and violence. It got to the point where the police refused to go to St. Louis's Pruitt-Igoe Towers, which would be demolished in front of a televised audience only 18 years after the first residents moved in. Across the United States, the wrecking ball and dynamite stick visited other infamous housing projects, such as Chicago's Robert Taylor Homes and Atlanta's McDaniel Glenn Homes. Joyless towers casting shadows over segregated and desolate areas of their cities. Given what the projects had become, blowing them up was not only the cheaper option, it was the most humane one, like bulldozing a house in which some unspeakable thing had once transpired. Out of this rubble, the voucher program sprung to life. Whatever else vouchers were, they were not Pruitt-Igoe or Robert Taylor, or all the other public housing complexes that had come to be synonymous with urban violence, bitter poverty, and policy failure. Today, the federally funded Housing Choice Voucher Program helps families secure decent housing units in the private rental market. Serving over 2.1 million households, this program has become the largest housing subsidy program for low-income families in the United States. An additional 1.2 million families live in public housing. Cities such as Philadelphia, Seattle, and Oakland have reimagined public housing, often as low-rise, attractive buildings dispersed over several neighborhoods. By and large, both public housing residents and voucher holders pay only 30% of their income on rent, with government funds covering the remaining costs. Public initiatives that provide low-income families with decent housing they can afford are among the most meaningful and effective anti-poverty programs in America. Not every public housing resident or voucher holder is poor. Many are elderly or disabled. Others have modest incomes. But every year, rental assistance programs lift roughly 2.8 million people out of poverty. These programs reduce homelessness and allow families to devote more resources to health care, transportation, and food. When families finally receive housing vouchers after years on the waiting list, the first place many take their freed-up income is to the grocery store. They stock the refrigerator and cupboards. Their children become stronger, less anemic, better nourished. But the majority of poor families aren't so lucky. And their children, children like Jory, Kendall, and Ruby, are not getting enough food because the rent eats first. In 2013, 1% of poor renters lived in rent-controlled units, 15% lived in public housing, and 17% received a government subsidy, mainly in the form of a rent-reducing voucher. The remaining 67%, two of every three poor renting families, received no federal assistance. This drastic shortfall in government support, coupled with rising rent and utility costs alongside stagnant incomes, is the reason why most poor renting families today spend most of their income on housing. Imagine if we didn't provide unemployment insurance or Social Security to most families who needed these benefits. Imagine if the vast majority of families who applied for food stamps were turned away hungry. And yet, this is exactly how we treat most poor families seeking shelter. A problem as big as the affordable housing crisis calls for a big solution. It should be at the top of America's domestic policy agenda, because it is driving poor families to financial ruin and even starting to engulf families with moderate incomes. Today, over one in five of all renting families in the country spends half of its income on housing. America can and should work to make its cities livable again. Meaningful change comes in various shapes and sizes. Some solutions are slow-going and costly, especially those involving fundamental reform. Other solutions, smaller ones, are more immediately feasible. Consider the courts. Legal aid to the poor has been steadily diminishing since the Reagan years and was decimated during the Great Recession. The result is that in many housing courts around the country, 90% of landlords are represented by attorneys and 90% of tenants are not. Low-income families on the edge of eviction have no right to counsel. But when tenants have lawyers, their chances of keeping their homes increase dramatically. Establishing publicly funded legal services for low-income families in housing court would be a cost-effective measure that would prevent homelessness, decrease evictions, and give poor families a fair shake. In the 1963 landmark case, Gideon v. Wainwright, the Supreme Court unanimously established the right to counsel for indigent defendants in criminal cases on the grounds that a fair trial was impossible without a lawyer. 18 years later, the court heard the case of Abby Gail Lassiter, a poor black North Carolinian who appeared without counsel at a civil trial that resulted in her parental rights being terminated. This time, a divided court ruled that defendants had a right to counsel only when they risked losing their physical liberty. Incarceration is a misery, but the outcomes of civil cases also can be devastating. Just ask Ms. Lassiter. Good lawyers would raise defenses tenants often don't, because they either are unaware of them or, like Arlene, are too nervous and intimidated to mount a strong argument. They would curb frivolous evictions and unchecked abuses and help prevent tenants from signing bad stipulations. If it weren't so easy to evict someone, tenants like Doreen and Patrice could report dangerous or illegal conditions without fearing retaliation. If tenants had lawyers, they wouldn't need to go to court. They could go to work or stay home with their children while their attorney made their case. And their case would actually be made. Courts have shown little interest in addressing the fact that the majority of tenants facing eviction never show up. If anything, they have come to depend on this because each day brings a pile of eviction cases. And the goal of every person working in housing court, no matter where their sympathies lie, is just to get through the pile. Because the next day, another pile will be there waiting. The principle of due process has been replaced by mere process, pushing cases through. Tenant lawyers would change that. This would cost money, not only in attorney salaries, but also in the hiring of more commissioners, judges, and clerks to handle the business of justice. Every housing court would need to be adequately funded so that it could function like a court instead of an eviction assembly line, stamp, stamp, stamp. It would be a worthwhile investment in our cities and children. Directing aid upstream in the form of a few hours of legal services could lower costs downstream. For example, a program that ran from 2005 to 2008 in the South Bronx provided more than 1,300 families with legal assistance and prevented eviction in 86% of cases. It cost around $450,000, but saved New York City more than $700,000 in estimated shelter costs alone. The consequences of eviction are many, and so are its burdens on the public purse. The right to counsel in civil matters has been established around the world, not just in France and Sweden, but also in Azerbaijan, India, Zambia, and many other countries we like to think of as less progressive than our own. If America extended the right to counsel in housing court, it would be a major step on the path to a more fair and equitable society. But it would not address the underlying source of America's eviction epidemic, the rapidly shrinking supply of affordable housing. If we acknowledge that housing is a basic right of all Americans, then we must think differently about another right. The right to make as much money as possible by providing families with housing, and especially to profit excessively from the less fortunate. Since the founding of this country, a long line of American visionaries have called for a more balanced relationship, one that protects people from the profit motive, not to destroy individualism, in Franklin D. Roosevelt's words, but to protect it. Child labor laws, the minimum wage, workplace safety regulations, and other protections we now take for granted came about when we chose to place the well-being of people above money. There are losers and winners.